Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 26th of August. Our guest this hour, Leslie Kane, is the author of UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. Leslie has been investigating this for some 10 years, and she says she addresses the fundamental questions about UFOs that concern so many people. What do we really know about them? Is it actually possible that some of these objects are from outer space? Do pilots ever see them? How do governments and militaries handle sightings? And you'll find through our discussion that governments handle them in very different ways. Why is there so much ridicule and denial about UFOs in America? The answers on all counts, she says, are nothing short of astonishing. Leslie is an investigative journalist who's been published internationally and nationally in the Boston Globe, the Baltimore Sun, Atlantic Journal Constitution, Providence Journal, The Nation, the International Herald Tribune, the Globe and Mail, and the Journal of Scientific Exploration. She is co-author of Burma's Revolution of the Spirit and co-founder of the Coalition for Freedom of Information. We'll be welcoming phone calls for her as we talk about UFOs this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And our email address, feel free to use that, is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hi, Leslie. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm looking forward to the discussion. I saw you on Colbert this week. Do you think he brushed you off?
Oh, no, not at all.
Really?
I don't know. It depends on how familiar you are with Stephen Colbert. I mean, the thing about Stephen Colbert is if people watch him regularly and get an idea of who he is, I mean, he is basically playing a character. He's not just a straight guy. He's playing a character, and he treats everybody like this. I mean, he's a comedian. So I think, no, I mean, I didn't feel that way at all. I felt like he engaged me in the same way and gave me the same kinds of silly lines and, you know, retorts that he gives to everybody that he has on the show. And I had an absolutely wonderful time.
Did you? Great. And
it's
great to have the book on that show. I'm sure it does great things for the book.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. It really, really. I mean, so many people watched the show, and it did. It gave the book what he calls the Colbert bump. He talks about that a lot on his show.
Right.
So I was just so familiar with him, and I watch the show a lot, and I'm a huge fan. So that really prepared me. I mean, for somebody who didn't know what they were going to be up against, it would be very difficult to deal with him.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
But I really admire him. I think he's really brilliant.
Yeah.
And, you know, have no problem with
how
the
I'm
show
glad,
went. So.
I'm glad you had that experience. So somebody gives you, tell the story, and I guess it must have been about 10 years ago, or this report. You're working on the West Coast. You're a producer and a radio host, and you're given this report from France on UFOs, and all of a sudden it literally changes the direction of your work.
Absolutely. That was the turning point for me, and it was back in 1999, and I was, as you said, I was a co-host and co-producer on a public radio show in California at KPFA. Some of your listeners might know that station.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, a colleague and friend sent me this advanced English translation of this 90-page report that had been put together by a group of generals. There was probably four of them, you know, four-star general among them, an admiral, the former head of the French National Space Agency, which would be the equivalent of our NASA, the chief of police. A lot of these, most of them were retired, but very high-level people in France, scientists, engineers, and they had spent 3 years studying official data on UFOs. And this is not, you know, Joe Blow on the street seeing lights in the sky. These are official documented cases from around the world. And they did a lot of their own case investigations and interviews as well. And they put together this report about what they learned. And what was so startling to me as a journalist at the time, of course, the case reports were fascinating, but it was their conclusion. And their conclusion was that what they called the extraterrestrial hypothesis was the most rational and most likely explanation for the cases that they studied. So that, to me, as a journalist, was like, wow, you know, for people at this stature, at this level, to come out with a statement like that, that's pretty significant.
Mm-hmm.
And so that got me going on, and I haven't stopped since.
But you had to be quiet about it, you said, at first, because people thought that people who were interested in studying UFOs were slightly off base.
Exactly, and this is a big problem, that what we call the ridicule factor. And I think it was worse then than it is now. And I also think I was probably a little overly sensitive about it, but I was really sensitive about it when I first started. Partly because when you're first learning something, of course, you don't know enough to really be able to hold your ground. So I didn't want people at this radio station where I worked. And again, these were my friends, my colleagues, people who I worked with daily and respected and everything. I still was sort of very, very quiet about it. And there was this, there's this taboo against the UFO subject, which I've come up against in many different ways over the years. And that's also dealt with in the book. I mean, we really examine why that's there, how it originated, and what can be done about it, and what are the psychological underpinnings of that taboo. So one of the purposes of this book is to try to dismantle that whole aspect of, you know, this sort of ridicule that everybody associates with UFOs. It's just totally irrational and inappropriate.
And yet it tends to be particularly American, doesn't it? Because in other, you have people from Belgium and from France and Iran and other places where they do fairly thorough reports of UFOs. In America, they give false information. What's up?
Exactly. I mean, you're spot on. This is absolutely right. And we contrast America in the book to these other countries. And yeah, there. And it's a very complicated. There's a lot of complicated reasons for this. But just to highlight that contrast. I mean, when there is an event that happens in one of the other countries that you mentioned, the let's say Belgium. There was this incredible Belgian a wave of sightings that took place in '89 and '90. You know, everything is officially investigated, and it's public. I mean, it's just what you expect any rational official body to do. If there are some strange craft that keep coming into the airspace, restricted airspace over a country, and that country has no idea what they are, where they're from, I mean, it would make sense that they would be pretty concerned about this. And Belgium, you know, put its Air Force on it. It used civil aviation people. It did a major investigation, sent F-16s up to try to get closer to these things. And they didn't hide any of that from the public. They actually held a press conference to try to explain it to people. And they were willing to acknowledge that they could not figure out what these things were. By contrast, in America, I think everybody probably realizes that, first of all, the government will not respond at all. If it's forced to, because people are very persistent about making inquiries, the government will just make up something or give a ridiculous explanation. And that's it. And we have an example, which we can talk about if you want, was the O'Hare case.
Yes,
in
2006. Please.
That's a striking example. Would you like me to talk about that?
Please talk about it. When you talked about it and wrote about it in the book, I looked up the Chicago Tribune reporter on this, too, who had to deal with this again because
right.
of you being on the Colbert Report, I guess, this week.
That's so funny. Yeah, it got mentioned for people that don't know, we were discussing this case a little bit. I was with Stephen Colbert on Monday, and then there were so many hits that the Chicago Tribune did a couple of stories about it again. It was pretty amazing. But just to let me lay that out for people, in 2006 there was a metallic-looking disc that was hovering over the United Airlines terminal at Chicago O'Hare. This was in the middle of rush hour, around 4:30 in the afternoon, kind of an overcast day. And this thing was hanging right below a cloud bank, about 1,500 feet up, and lots of United Airlines employees saw it, including pilots. It was there for at least 5 minutes. There was lots of chatter about it on the radio, and people were calling into the tower. You know, all these things were on tape. I mean, there was no question this thing was there. It's just no question there were a lot of witnesses to it, and they're competent witnesses. So then the thing, after hovering there for a while, it shot straight up through the cloud bank, which was right above it. Just zoomed straight up and cut this crisp hole through the clouds. It was like a cookie cutter hole. It was clean edge, round hole through the clouds and disappeared. And, you know, we don't have anything that can do that. That's the bottom line. So our government's, you know, our government's response was, the FAA was, of course, hit up for information. At first, they wouldn't say anything. The second thing they came out with was, it was lights reflecting off the clouds. They said it was lights reflecting off the clouds. Well, the irony of that was that the lights weren't even on yet because it was too early in the afternoon. Secondly, of course, any United Airlines employee could recognize what the lights on the clouds would look like. They wouldn't start talking about disks flying up and cutting holes in clouds if it was lights, right? I mean, these explanations can be insulting to the witnesses. Pressed even further, they said, it was a weather phenomenon. So that was sort of left on the record for quite a while, a weather phenomenon, whatever that means. So I decided a few months later to call up the spokesperson for the FAA who had said it was a weather phenomenon and ask him a little bit more about what kind of weather this might be, because all the weather is recorded at these airports, the National Weather Service. There's all kinds of data about the weather, and it was just a typical day. There was nothing special about the weather that day. So I pressed the guy for more details, and he said it was probably a hole-punch cloud, which is what I thought he was going to say, which is a natural phenomenon that you see very rarely where a kind of a hole forms in a cloud because of ice crystals that are falling from above, and they melt part of the inside of a cloud, and you get this large hole. So what I learned about that, I said, okay, a hole-punch cloud, and I called up a bunch of climatologists and scientists and other people, experts in weather, and they told me that it could not possibly have been a hole-punch cloud because they can only form it below freezing temperatures, which it was not at O'Hare that day. So he came up with an explanation, the FAA representative, that's absolutely untenable. And this is what happened. And if you compare that with what happened in Belgium and how responsibly they handled their events, there's just a world of difference. So part of the purpose of the book is to make this very clear and to hope that we can change the way the U.S. government approaches this.
Well, you would think that just for airline safety, tell me about this element of all of this, that pilots, that everybody would be notified there's this object, because it could be, as you indicate with other stories here in the book, it could interfere with a pilot, with a plane that's trying to take off from O'Hare at that time. I don't understand why there wouldn't be more public information about this, because surely there has to be some kind of investigation to make sure that the planes are leaving safely, wouldn't there?
Absolutely. I mean, that's just the most rational thing you could possibly think, and that's why the witnesses were concerned. I mean, a lot of the witnesses were concerned about aviation safety, and of course it's a legitimate concern. I mean, even above the cloud bank, something could have been coming in that might not have seen the hovering thing. When it shot up through the clouds, it could have hit something. And yes, any object that hovers over an airport during rush hour is a safety hazard, without a question. So that's where it gets to the level of, you know, irresponsibility and negligence when authorities don't take that seriously. I mean, that you're absolutely right. It's not just about our curiosity. It's about safety.
And you include a tape. Can you talk about that tape in the book, the transcription of a tape between, was it somebody from United Airlines and the control tower?
Yeah, I believe, I mean, exactly the one you mean. It was somebody from the airline calling into the FAA in the control tower.
Right.
Reporting that this disc was hovering there. Now, the people in the control tower didn't, because of the way the tower was situated, they didn't have a direct line of vision to the object, so they couldn't see it with their eyes. But they were getting reports, and one of the employees called in and described it and said it's there, the pilots are talking about it. And if you read this transcript, it's just fascinating to see how this woman was laughed at for reporting something that was actually physically present in that moment and was a safety hazard. And just because she used the word UFO, the guy in the tower was sort of laughing, and then she felt she had to explain to the person that she had not been drinking or taking drugs.
Right.
You know, and all of this ignorance is because people are not educated in these airports, and you know, all these officials and the airline people are not educated about one other potential hazard in the skies, which is UFOs. And it should just be mixed right in there with wind shear and other, I mean, there's a list of other, you know, bird strikes, things that occur very rarely but are considered hazards by the FAA, and the pilots are trained how to deal with them.
Mm-hmm.
And the UFO phenomenon is just completely left out of that mix, even though it also occurs and affects aircraft and can be a safety hazard. So there's just a total irrationality about how people approach this.
Well, part of the reason, and I'm sure that you've heard from many people who have said they were abducted by UFOs, they've spent 3 years living with them, and these are the kinds of people they are. I mean, if you do radio, you hear that, and I'm sure that Chrissy will get calls. We will not put those on the air from those people. Which keeps you from the people who you brought together, and you brought many of them to Washington, D.C. for a press conference, who are from the military, who are government officials, who are pilots who have gone after UFOs, people who are legitimate about this and have a lot of evidence to present.
Right. And I do think you're right. There's a lot of very sort of crazy stuff out there around UFOs and a lot of wacky people that hang out and, you know, play with the UFO issue. And one of my jobs as a journalist was to sort out what is valid information and what isn't, and I wanted to give that to people to say, you no longer have to be confused, because here's what's really factual, here's what we actually do know for sure, and here are the questions that we still need to answer. But I also don't want to disparage research that people may have been doing about some of these issues of abductions. I mean, it's not something I deal with at all. But I think there's some very interesting research that has been done on that. There have been reports coming in for many, many, many years. That's a whole other area, and it's not to disparage that when it's being handled seriously and, you know, from a scientific approach. And there has been some interesting work done, just to add that to it.
Okay.
But, yes, there's a lot of really wacky stuff out there, and that's very unfortunate.
Did you have the sense, and we'll talk about some of the pilots and government officials who are, their testimony is included in this book, as you did this, you had enough pilots, enough government officials, enough reports that were legitimate to make this scientifically valid, that indeed there were unidentified flying objects. Tell me about the number of people who you felt were valid who came forth with the information.
You mean specifically in the book, right?
Yes.
And I just want to put out the title of the book, actually, for people who are listening. It's called UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. And I do have a website, which is UFOsOnTheRecord.com. And people can go there, and there's information about the book, and you can buy it really easily there if you want to. So, again, that's UFOsOnTheRecord.com. I hope it's okay that I interject that.
It's okay.
I have in this book, and what's really interesting about the book, as far as I'm concerned, is that the people that I have, the people you just referenced, have actually written their own chapters for the book. So you're not just reading my reports. You're reading in the words of the people themselves what they have to say. And there's 18 people who have contributed to the book, and they're all extremely high-level credentialed people. I mean, there's one of them was the former head of accidents investigations for the FAA. Another one is a former governor of Arizona. A lot of them are retired, but not all of them. We have also from Chile a young captain who is an expert who deals with, he was in the army in Chile, and he works openly on the issue for the government there. A whole range of people from different countries, a former head of the United Kingdom's official UFO agency, the former head of the French official UFO agency. This man, Jean-Jacques Velasco, was head of the French investigation for 20 years, and they have one of the best agencies in the world. We have a general from France. I mean, there are five generals that have written in their own words for this book about their investigations and their witnessing of this phenomena. So it's quite a collection of people. I don't think, and they're all coming together in one place here, and basically pointing to the same conclusion, which is one, as you said, there is without a doubt an unknown phenomenon that is here, that is in our skies, and we have enough documentation to say that for certain these things exist. Number two, we do not know what they are. We can't jump to conclusions that they're extraterrestrial or whatever. We don't know what they are. And number three, we need to have a cooperative international investigation at much higher levels than has been done so far to get to the bottom of the issue and to make the results public so that we can solve the mystery once and for all.
Leslie Kane is our guest this hour. She is the author of the just-released book, UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. We'll take your phone calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now, and let's start our calls with Mark from North Freedom. Hello, Mark.
Hello.
Hi.
I just returned from a trip to Colorado, and we traveled through the San Luis Valley, and apparently there's some UFO viewing station out there in the San Luis Valley. It's about, I don't know, 17 miles north of Highway 160 on the western side of Highway 17. And I guess because of the altitude and the clear air, it's a good place to look up into the sky, lack of light pollution, that kind of thing. And I'm just wondering if your guest knows anything about it. And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Yeah, I think I've read about it. If this is the one I'm thinking of, it's like a platform that goes, you know, that's high off the ground. But I have to say I've never been there. It sounds intriguing to me, and I've read a little bit about it. But other than that, I really can't add anything to his description. He's the one that's been there, and I haven't. So,
how many sightings are we talking here? Thousands of sightings or just a few sightings?
Well, I mean, overall, we're talking about probably millions if you want to include every sighting that ever been reported by every person. We're talking, you know, millions of sightings. But we have to whittle those down. And, you know, one of the points that's really important for everyone to realize is that 95% of all UFO sightings can be explained. 95% of them are, you know, something like, you know, some man-made technology or weather or whatever, satellites or weather balloons. There's all kinds of things that can be mistaken for.
Right.
Or that when you look up, you think, well, I can't explain what this is, therefore I'm going to call it a UFO. But, well, so, you know, people do have to realize that. But it's the 5%, it's that remaining 5% of cases that the ones we're concerned about. And out of those 5%, we're concerned with the cases that have been so thoroughly investigated at official levels that there is no explanation for them. But in other words, they have enough data to be able to be determine that all possible explanations have been eliminated.
Okay, and how many of those are there?
How many cases total? Gosh, I couldn't tell you because so many governments have cases that we probably don't even know about. I mean, all the cases in the book fit that category, in my book, but
right. There
are many more, many more. And that's a really interesting question as to how many. You know, I'm sure there probably are hundreds if you're considering all the governments in the world that have had anything to do with this.
Mm-hmm.
Hundreds and hundreds of them. Not of course, and you know, it's just very hard to access all of them because they're scattered all over the world. But more and more governments have been releasing their files on the UFO subject in the last 10 years. Many, many governments have done so. So we have a lot of cases and a lot of great information that shows the absolute certainty of the existence of this.
We go to Colvin near Duluth. Hi.
Hello. I actually was supposed to ask two questions. One was about the origin of UFOs, which sort of coincides with electromagnetic research, which was pioneered primarily in Germany during World War II, which is when a lot of the UFO reports actually started, which were initially like glowing white spheres, which would trail aircraft. And I have this report here from December 1980. Betty Cash, Vicki Landrum, and Landrum's grandson encountered a large glowing diamond-shaped object hovering in the air near the small town of Huffman, Texas. And supported by other witnesses, the object was surrounded by military CH-47 helicopters. And days later, they experienced painful swelling, skin blisters, along with headaches, nausea, and hair loss, which are all the symptoms of electromagnetic radiation. And also in 1985, they brought a suit against the U.S. government for $20 million in damages, but it was dismissed based on denials by the government that any such craft existed in its inventory. I wanted to know if you had heard anything about that and if you knew anything about the origins of UFOs in Germany, basically, which sort of transferred over to the United States after the induction of numerous Nazi scientists into the military-industrial complex.
Yes, well, the first part, I mean, some people have proposed that this is, you know, the whole thing about the German origin, that some of the UFOs could have been manufactured by Germany. It's, of course, possible that some of the sightings may have been some kind of test disc from Germany, but there's no question that the kind of maneuvers and speeds and, you know, The way these objects perform in the sky is just simply not explainable by saying, you know, that this is coming out of scientific studies in Germany or test craft or whatever in the 1940s. I mean, there are just too many events all over the world. There are many crafts that have different shapes. They're not all disc shaped. Some of them are triangular shaped. And they perform in such ways that there's just an impossible explanation for them. I mean, when you talk about the origin of UFOs, the bottom line is we don't know the origin of these really extraordinary cases. And, you know, as a, that's basically the situation. The second, the Cash Landrum UFO incident is a really, really fascinating case, which he brought up. There, you know, there have been questions as to whether the object or the UFO, the UFO or whatever it was, might have been an experimental craft of the American government. And I don't think the case was ever determined definitively one way or the other. But it is, and of course, people who have gotten close to UFOs have received burns and radiation effects and so on. You can be certain that they are emitting a lot of electromagnetic radiation and possibly other kinds of radiation. That would be something one would expect from some kind of highly technological thing. But I just wanted to say, for anybody who's interested in learning more about the Cash Landrum case, there is a book called The Cash Landrum UFO Incident, written by John Schussler, Schussler, which is excellent and gives all the transcripts of the interviews and all the information on it. And I would suggest that people read that book if they want to learn more.
Thanks, Calvin, for the call. Here's an email. Are you aware of any UFO sightings that have not only been viewed by those on an airplane, but also on an airport radar, showing that something other than the airplane was in the sky? I thought I had heard of something like that, where not only did a veteran pilot view it, but it was also showing up on his radar.
Yes, I mean, absolutely. There are numerous cases where radar captures a UFO. It's also seen by the pilots. It's also seen by passengers. And it can be picked up on the radar, both in the pilot's plane up in the sky and on the ground at the same time. I mean, this does happen, and there's a number of cases that we cover in the book where that happened. One of them is the 1986 event over Alaska, in which a gigantic UFO was seen by some pilots for quite a while. That one was picked up on radar. Another one is the 2007 case over the Channel Islands. That was very recent. The pilot, Ray Bowyer, in that case, wrote a chapter in the book as well, and he saw two gigantic UFOs hanging out in the sky over the Channel Islands. His passengers saw them also. A pilot from another plane in another location saw the objects, and they were picked up on radar. So it's quite common, but, you know, sometimes the objects seem to escape the radar, too, and we don't really understand why sometimes they're picked up and why sometimes they aren't. The O'Hare disc that we were talking about earlier was not picked up on radar. Part of it has to do with the way the radar is configured and what it's programmed to show and what it's not, and we have some coverage on that in the book, too. It's a complicated question, but cases of visual sightings and radar happening at the same time are really among our best cases and our most convincing cases, and we do have quite a few of them.
And what has happened to the instrument panels of those who have gone after UFOs, thinking that they were a military threat? There have been some interesting things that have happened with their instruments on the plane.
That's really one of the more amazing accounts in the book, I believe. It was written by a general who's an Iranian general now. His name is Parviz Jafari, but at the time this event happened, he was in the Air Force. He was basically an Air Force pilot. It was in 1976. He was ordered up by a general to go examine at closer range this gigantic, triangular, brilliant object that was sitting in the sky. And another group of pilots went up also. And what you were pointing out was so fascinating, that when they got too close to the object, they lost their equipment. But another thing happened. At one point, some smaller objects came out of the larger one, and they were heading right for General Jafari's plane. And he thought he had to fire a missile in self-defense. He was very frightening. So he loaded up his missiles. He had a heat-seeking missile so he could lock right onto the target. He was all ready to fire, and just at the moment where he's about to press that button, he lost all control of his instruments. This happened three or four times, that just at the moment he was about to fire, he lost control of his – his equipment just went down, and it was unusable. It was kind of, you know, uncanny, because – it was seemed as if somehow the UFOs seemed to know, if you want to use that word, when he was about to fire and had the ability to disable his missile system. And it couldn't have been a coincidence, because it happened too many times. So This was one of the examples of what we call intelligent control, that these objects seem to have intelligent control and have some kind of intelligence that can tell, because they respond in certain ways to very specific things. And this is an example of that.
Polly in Two Rivers is next. Hi, Polly.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to share a story. When I was about 13 years old back in Boston, my entire neighborhood, well, not the entire neighborhood, but quite a few of us, it was late at night, and there was a lot of commotion, and people were yelling, and I went to my backyard first and then went out front, and a number of us, and there probably was at least 20, we saw this object in the sky. It was very, very low, just above the house top. I would say cylindrical, cigar-shaped, with very bright lights, and, of course, everybody was, we were very excited and yelling and whatnot, and it only hovered for a little bit, and then it was off, and you barely even saw it take off. I remember telling, when I went into the ninth grade, the story, and, of course, people just laughed, and I always say, I know what I saw, our neighbors know what we saw, and they dismissed it as, I think, air, something with air quality or fog or something like that, and it just, you know, we just all said, well, we know what we saw. So it was interesting, and it was a long time ago, and it was when the UFO phenomena started to come about.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if she can hear me, but I assume you'll never forget that.
Oh, absolutely not. And like I said, it makes me believe that there are other beings in the in the universe, that we are not the only ones. I think they're a lot smarter than we are, and I guess it's exciting to think about it, and I have never delved into a lot of information about this, so I might have to get your book, but I would be very interested to see what the officials have to say about this.
Right, and the stories in the book are really, really thrilling. I mean, it's not like it's dry. You're reading about very close encounters with objects, and I'm sure you'll read about some that look like the one that you saw. And I just want to say that her story is so typical of so many people. There are so many multiple witness sightings. I mean, I went into a television studio to do an interview. You know, the TV guy comes up to me and tells me a story. I mean, people come up to me all the time with these incredible witnessings that they've had of these things, and I just want her to know that there are many, many, many other people that report the same thing.
Thanks.
And that's why it just seems so important that we get to the bottom of this.
Thanks, Polly, for the call. Let's go back to Chicago for a moment. You do have some remarkable pictures in your book, but it was striking to me, with so many witnesses in Chicago, why wasn't there, and you know, people carry cameras all the time, why weren't there pictures of what happened at O'Hare?
It's a good question, and I mean, people. I don't think a lot of the people have cameras, but they do have cell phones with
yes,
you know, that they can take pictures with. And there's a whole complicated thing around what happens when people see UFOs. First of all, they are so mesmerized and so focused on what they're seeing that most people don't even think about taking a picture because their eyes are fixated on what they're seeing, and they do not want to take their eyes off of it. They don't know how long it's going to be there. They're just kind of staring in disbelief. Maybe after a while, so they don't want to go fumbling around looking for their camera. But some people do. And, you know, again, we did get a report that there was one picture taken in O'Hare. Lots of times, though, if you take an object way up in the sky with a cell phone, it's not going to even come out. It's not going to be worth very much. You know, your eye might be able to see it a lot better. So I think it's an issue that comes up all the time. During the Phoenix Lights incident in 1997, which was very, very dramatic, there just were not pictures taken because people were absolutely just stunned and staring at what they saw. They could see it moving. They knew they only had a few minutes to watch, and they just don't want to take their eyes off it and go find their cameras. So maybe if you have something in your pocket, you'll pull it out.
Right.
And that could have happened at O'Hare,
yeah,
as we said, we heard that it did. But for some reason, the picture hasn't been provided, and I have no idea why that is. But it isn't that surprising to me because there are so many cases where pictures aren't taken, although in the book we do have some incredible pictures, one of them from Belgium in 1990 that's just a glorious picture of a UFO. but it's not as common as you might think. And then the pictures have to be carefully analyzed, and unfortunately there are a lot of people that hoax pictures now because of Photoshop.
Right.
There's so many hoaxed pictures, and you have to be so careful as to what you can accept as being authentic, which is another problem.
Yeah. Let's go to Harriet next. Hi, Harriet.
Hi, Leslie. You've made a very reasonable and credible presentation. Now, there must be people in the U.S. government who'd like to release all of the information that the government and the military have about UFOs. Do you think that disclosure of government information about UFOs is likely to happen soon?
Well, there's two parts of that. One, yes, there are people in Washington who are interested in this issue, and one of them is John Podesta, who we didn't actually mention, wrote the foreword to this book. He was President Obama's chief organizer and he was chief of staff under President Clinton. He's a very powerful person. And he has called for all information to be disclosed. And I know there are people in the government interested in this. The problem is the ridicule factor. But the second part of that point is that I really think that at this point it's not so much about releasing more documents, releasing what the government might know, because there is so many documentation already out there. There's so much out there already. If we just get a bunch more case reports from government, it's not going to change anything. The highly sensitive documents, which might really tell us something, are going to be classified. They're just not going to be released. So we have a proposal in the book for a new approach, which is, and I'll just say very briefly, which is basically to get a government official instigated in a small office within the government structure who can become the official focal point for UFO investigations. And what needs to happen is more investigations of things that happen now as opposed to getting more documents released. It's sort of a different way of looking at it, which is the way France handles it in other countries. When an event happens, that's when they mobilize to investigate. That's when they can really maybe learn something new. So we have to learn something. We need more information, but we don't need as much documentation as people might think, because we already have many, many, many documents.
Our guest this hour is Leslie Kane. She is the author of UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. She brought a number of these people together at the press club in Washington recently, and I want to talk to her about that. And we'll welcome more phone calls. Harriet, thanks for yours. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I know you brought a number of the people who have accounts in your book to Washington, to the press club, not very long ago. Can you tell me about what they said to each other and who was at the event, what happened as a result of it?
This was an event, actually, I organized with James Fox, who's a filmmaker who made a documentary called I Know What I Saw, which covered this press event. And it provided me with the opportunity to bring some of the people over to this country who have actually written chapters for the book and to get to know some of them, and also for them to make statements to the press, which were very powerful. They were very short statements. Again, it was all high-level government officials and scientists who were standing there at the podium presenting information. And they got to spend a lot of time talking to each other as well, which was just such a great thing to have these men come from all over the globe who had never met each other but had all had extraordinary experiences and conducted official investigations into this. And to have them be able to sit down and talk to each other was really, really a special thing. And I was just really moved by being able to be part of that and being able to witness these discussions, particularly the two pilots who have both written chapters for the book, one of them from Iran, who we talked about earlier, and another one from Peru, who also
shot
at a UFO. Yeah, these are two guys. Very rare that you have a case where Air Force pilots have actually either shot at a UFO or attempted to. And these two guys had these extraordinary close encounters in which they were firing at these things, had never talked to each other, never met each other, didn't know anything about the other person's case. And they met for the first time at our press conference, and it was just a thrilling, thrilling time to sit down with them and watch them communicate to each other about these extraordinary things that had happened to them, and knowing exactly what the other person was feeling, and they could really connect, even though they were from completely different parts of the globe. One of them didn't speak English. I mean, it was just So that was it was a very successful event. The press conference, of course, got a lot of coverage, but the difference between that and what I'm trying to do in the book is that the press conference was four-minute little speeches by these people.
Mm-hmm.
In the book, they are writing in detail, and they've worked hard at presenting a really good narrative about with much more detail and much more personal emotion and, you know, expanded stories and in their own words about these things. So it's sort of, it's the first time that they've done this, that they've really written in detail. So this was sort of a jump from the press conference to try to give more information.
Right.
And a lot of the people in the book were not at the press conference, too.
Let's go to Paul from Campbellsport. Hi, Paul.
Hi, how you doing? I got two things. One, back in 73, my family was living in Mount Sterling, Kentucky, and it was in June of 73 when my father and my brother and I were driving to town, and there was an object that was overhead that we had followed for 10 miles, and as we got closer to town, it took off. And the question I have is, during the 70s, they had a TV show called Operation Blue Book, and I wanted to know if that was an actual organization, and if so, is there a way to find out if a sighting that you may have experienced has been documented, and if you can locate that on the Internet at some website?
Yeah, well, just the second part of your question, at least nowadays, I forget, what year did you say this was, sir?
To find out if...
What year did you say, Kathleen, the sighting?
I didn't write down the year. What year was it? 1970,
June 1973.
Okay, it was a while ago. I mean, it would probably be very hard to find anything on it now. But what people, you know, in terms of reporting sightings like this, the best way to do that is the organization called MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network. It's MUFON. They have a big website. And this is they have directors in every single state in the country, and they are the place that anybody who sees something and wants to file it and wants to find out if other people have reported the same thing, that's the place to go, and you can find them online.
Oh.
He brought up about Project Blue Book. Project Blue Book was the Air Force official investigative body that was set up in the early 1950s, and it was shut down in 1970. So for about two decades, they were, you know, the place where people would go to report sightings, and there's a lot of activity on UFOs in the 50s and 60s. Lots of reports, lots of media. It was a big issue. And Project Blue Book, unfortunately, became a sort of a public relations effort where basically cases were ridiculed, dismissed, they were not thoroughly investigated. It was basically our government trying to just sort of get this off their backs, basically. It was not managed well, and there's a lot of papers that have been written about it and a lot of analysis
mm-hmm.
about it. And I do talk a lot about that in the book. It's really interesting to see what was going on behind the scenes with Project Blue Book. We're hoping to get a new agency set up that doesn't repeat the mistakes of Project Blue Book. But since the 1970, we've had no official agency at all.
Thanks, Paul. Dan in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Great show. I heard something in like 1997. I was walking my dog one evening in February, very low cloud ceiling, and I'm pretty familiar with a lot of different aircraft, and this thing sounded like nothing I'd ever heard. If you orient yourself to a clock dial, I would say it came from about 7 o'clock, and it got to about 2 o'clock, and all of a sudden the sound just vanished. So I don't know what I heard or what it was, but it was like nothing I'd ever heard before. And I also have a question about, as we get more extraterrestrial, will the orientation of time, past, present, and future, be the same, or will it be different? And my theory is some of these things that we are having experiences with are actually maybe ancestors from the future. I think it's us in an evolved, adaptive role to living beyond our own atmosphere here in this planet and occasionally coming back to whatever.
Right. I mean, that is something that other people have proposed as well, that these could be travelers from the future that are going back in time. And that's, it's a valid theory because but the bottom line is, you know, we should be able to find out what they are and not no longer have to say, well, I think it's this or I think it's that. We really do want to find out. But I don't think that that's an unreasonable proposition. And there are physicists now who have, in terms of the space-time continuum and all the different physical, you know, aspects of this in terms of what it would take to get here from somewhere else, there are physicists now who can explain how it would be possible for a spacecraft to travel through space-time and, you know, from very, very, very far away and arrive on this planet. Michio Kaku is one of the great physicists who has done a lot of work on this. So it's fascinating to speculate on it. I'm just, I think it's about time we should end the need to speculate and figure out what they actually are. And I think we can do that if we just decide to put our minds to it.
You think we can, even though their capabilities are so far beyond what ours are? Are they beyond our understanding then, too, if we don't know how anything can move that fast? Or how are we going to know what they are if we don't know exactly how they can do what they can do?
Well, I mean, it's a really good question, and I can't really answer that. I just come from the position that, you know, the brilliant scientists that we have on this planet that are able to build, you know, 5-mile particle accelerators and break up atoms into tiny pieces and are able to tell us what's going on in other galaxies. I mean, the extraordinary capabilities that our scientists have on this planet to discover and to learn and to develop methodologies to learn things that are very mysterious, to understand mysteries. I just can't believe that if they really got excited about UFOs and had enough resources to do whatever they needed to do to try to learn more about them, I think they could come up with some ways to do that. And maybe after a struggle with it, you're right, maybe they would say, well, you know, we can't do it, or it's a highly mysterious thing, but they haven't even tried yet. So it would be a very exciting adventure for the scientific community to take on.
Mm-hmm.
And I just have a lot of faith in their capabilities of learning something like, you know, just making discoveries that need to be made for the evolution of our planet. It's happened many times in the past. And I'm just going to give it to them to figure out how to do it.
Okay.
Hey, I can't tell you that.
Right. Bruce is next from Lodi. Hi, Bruce.
Hello. I just wanted to relate to something that happened to me when I was a young boy. I was 12. This was in 1958. And my father had a friend of his that he'd gone to. They grew up together, and they were both pilots. And his friend had stayed in the military, and so he was a colonel. He was a Marine aviator. And he was. He said that he was assigned to Operation Blue Book. And so they were talking about that. My father asked me, he said, well, you know, are there terrestrials? And his friend said, well, officially, no. But he said, personally, just between you and me, there's not a doubt in my mind. So, and they went on to talk about other things. And I verified that conversation later on. My dad said, yep, that's what he said. So I don't know what all that meant, except that he was absolutely convinced that there were extraterrestrials.
Yeah, that's really interesting, and, you know, I just want to say that there are so many reports like that of people on the inside that have told somebody just what you basically told me. And, you know, of course, these are people who aren't on the record, who we can't corroborate what they're saying, but there are so many that have been close to the phenomenon, have been close to the official aspects of it, and have said, you know, statements like that. I'm convinced, or I know because I've seen the records, or... You know, it's a fascinating, and it's because I've been in this long enough, I've had enough of these people say this, exactly what this man has just said. It's really fascinating, and unfortunately, that's not information that has corroboration or documentation,
right.
So it's not going to be able to be used to actually prove anything to anyone, but the accumulation of reports like that is very compelling.
Have you seen a UFO?
I have not, no. And I actually am sort of glad I haven't. I mean, I would love to see one personally.
Oh, you of all people should.
But in terms of the professional role that I'm playing here as an objective observer and a journalist, I think it's probably better that I haven't, because people are really affected by this, by sightings.
How
so? I
mean,
it changes their lives. It
really?
Can be very disturbing to some people. And I just think, you know, this allows me to maintain a certain level of objectivity and kind of distance from the whole thing that, that I think is probably good, but I hope I wouldn't mind seeing one at some point.
Why does it change people's lives?
Well, I mean, so the people who have very close encounters, if you want to call them that, or, you know, they're very close to the object, or they're, you know, it can be very scary. I mean, when you have something that is a huge, brilliant thing, let's say hovering over your car, that is not supposed to exist. This is something that, you know, you think is only
right.
only exists in the movies, and you
right.
see it with your own eyes, and nobody will believe you. You're
right.
ridiculed, and yet you know you saw it, and you have no idea what it is. And in the moment, it can be scary because it's a very powerful, you know, completely mysterious thing that obviously has all kinds of powers, and you don't know what it's going to do to you, possibly.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a natural thing to be kind of unnerved by it. And then afterwards, it's just very transformative. A lot of people will change their perspective on what they think, how they mm. see things, you know.
Yeah. We're out of time. Thank you, Leslie, so much for being with us.
Thank you so much again. And my website, one more time, is UFOsOnTheRecord.com. I really appreciate, Kathleen, you're having me on.
Sure, Leslie. Leslie Kane. It's K-E-A-N. UFOs, generals, pilots, and government officials go on the record is the name of the book. And we thank her for being with us. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, Chrissy Pease for on-air production, and thanks for all of your calls. Great talk ahead.